You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster served in the U.S. Army for 34 years and then as National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. The author of the best-selling military classic Dereliction of Duty, he's written a new book in which he describes his efforts to reassess and fundamentally shift policies while he was on Trump's National Security Council, and offers a bold and provocative reexamination of the most critical foreign policy and national security challenges that face the United States today. The book is titled Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. And today, H.R. McMaster joins me on the podcast to discuss what it was like to take over the job of National Security Advisor in the chaotic period following the firing of his predecessor, Michael Flynn, how the lessons from LBJ's military cabinet during Vietnam made him even more determined to provide the president with straightforward, unvarnished policy advice, and why some other people in the president's inner circle might not have had the same motivations. He talks about the value of empathy in national security and foreign policy, and some of the biggest challenges America faces, including an emboldened China that's taking advantage of the COVID crisis to advance its own agenda and threaten its neighbors, and a Russia that he says is determined to drag America down with it. He explains why the war in Afghanistan is really a one-year war fought over and over 20 times, why he believes his departure from the Trump administration was largely the result of a social media smear campaign by Russian cyber trolls, how the National Security Council put in place a strategy for a global pandemic, and what went wrong. Coming up with H.R. McMaster in just a moment. H.R. McMaster is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and Stanford University. He's also a fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute and lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He serves as chairman of the advisory board at the Center on Military and Political Power at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and the Japan chair at the Hudson Institute. He served as a U.S. Army officer for 34 years and retired as a lieutenant general in 2018. He remained on active duty while serving as the 26th assistant to the president for national security affairs. Now he writes about the experience and more in his new book, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. H.R. McMaster, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ben, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, I enjoyed the book. I was a little surprised by the opening to it. The very first line of the book, you say, this is not a book that most people wanted me to write. Was there a lot of pressure on you to write a tell-all?
Yeah, it seemed like everybody wanted me to write a tell-all. Mm. And of course, you know, it would have been lucrative to do that. Mm. But, you know, I felt like it wouldn't be useful, right? I mean, you know, how many more tell-alls or palace intrigue books do we need? And Ben, as I went on to say in the preface, I mean, I hope that this is a book that can generate meaningful and respectful discussion about the most crucial challenges we're mm-hmm. facing as a way to bring people together, you know, and for us to figure out what we can do together to build a better future for generations to come.
Still, certainly there would have been a financial incentive there and maybe even a personal desire to tell your side of the story and find some vindication. That wasn't tempting to you?
No, it wasn't. You know, And Ben, I'd served in the military for 34 years by the time I left the job. And the other dimension of this is, you know, the National Security Advisor is the only person in the foreign policy establishment who has the president as his or her only client. And then to violate confidence, you know, during that same president's term, I think would raise into question the loyalty of future national security advisors for any president. So I didn't want to do damage to the office, and certainly I didn't want to do damage to the military profession as well. And I think it's really important, especially these days, to ensure that our military stays completely above and away from any kind of partisan politics.
Yeah, and that's interesting what you bring up about just what a unique job it is, because unlike the SecDef or Secretary of State, you do pretty much essentially have one client, and that's the president. One would think that in some sense that makes it an easier job to do, but is that really the case?
You know, it's a fun job. It's an exciting job and a challenging job. And really, it sounds like it's just you and the president. But really, what's critical is that the National Security Advisor runs a process to coordinate and integrate efforts across the departments and agencies. So it's really important to establish a collaborative relationship, good relationships with the departments and agencies, convene them around our most crucial challenges. And then what we endeavor to do is to frame these challenges, to kind of apply design thinking to them, right? To understand these challenges on their own terms, to view them through the lens of vital interests, to craft goals and objectives, and then to really bring together that expertise across the government to figure out how we integrate all elements of national power, you know, diplomacy, military efforts, law enforcement, economic efforts, financial efforts, informational efforts, and efforts of like-minded partners around the world to advance and protect our interests, to make sure that our future is as safe as it can be, as prosperous as it can be.
Yeah, and here you describe the five major responsibilities of a national security advisor. I wonder if you would run us through those, and maybe even you might reveal which of those that you think that you really excelled at, and maybe one that wasn't so much in your wheelhouse.
Okay, well, the first of these is you staff the president, right? You prepare the president for any engagement or any decision or any meeting that having to do with foreign policy. And that's an immensely important job, especially, you know, during presidential travel, when the president is having phone conversations with or hosting foreign leaders, having conversations with members of the Senate or the House of Representatives on foreign policy. And then, of course, whenever he's about to engage with his cabinet, with his National Security Council on issues of grave importance to national security. So staffing the president, preparing the president is one big task. The second I mentioned, which is running that process. And I modeled myself after General Brent Scowcroft, who passed away sadly earlier this year, a real fine man and a true professional. And he viewed himself as National Security Advisor, as the honest broker, right? The person who wasn't actually advocating for particular policies and strategies, but instead was making sure the president had multiple options and could make the best possible decision based on the president's view and the president's agenda. The third key task is to coordinate efforts with like-minded partners to try to forge a common understanding and unity of effort, synergistic efforts with allies and those countries that we're cooperating with. And I really enjoyed that part of the job. I had some great counterparts as national security advisors. Sometimes you coordinate with foreign ministers or, you know, the equivalent of the Secretary of State, but that's rare. Or sometimes heads of state, because I had some pre-existing relationships with heads of state as well. And I think we worked extremely well together with our key allies during that period of time. The fourth is communicate the president's decisions and policies to the relevant audiences. That's certainly our representatives on the Hill, the Senate and House of Representatives. Sometimes it's also foreign audiences, but really it's also the American public at times. Now, I would prefer not to do that, actually, you know, to let the cabinet secretaries do that. But oftentimes, you know, they were reluctant to do so. So I had to do that on occasion. And then finally, you have to lead an organization, right? You want to build a National Security Council staff that is effective, that's trusted and valued across the government, and also one that an environment in which people want to come to work, right? Because they feel like they're making a difference and they're bound together by you know, by a sense of mission, doing something bigger than themselves, and they're bound together by mutual trust and respect within the organization itself. So, you know, I really, you know, I think in that last job, if you said which one I did well, I think it was that.
You, of course, came into that post at a particularly chaotic period early in the Trump administration. Your predecessor, Mike Flynn, was fired and under investigation for not disclosing some improper dealings with Russian officials. What was it like to step into that job at that moment?
I came into a turbulent environment. My predecessor left suddenly. You know, the transition to the Trump administration was dramatic, significant, based on, of course, the personality of Donald Trump, but also the vast differences in approach between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. As you may have noticed, and your listeners may have noticed, that we've become quite polarized and partisan in our
so just a bit.
So, but I think I was able to lead the organization through that difficult time and to do a good job for the president, which is what my mission was. Right, and you know, I think that running the process, I would say that it was strong as well. You know, I think in terms of staffing the president, right, I did my best on that. But I think in that job, in that environment, you know, I just got used up, frankly, right? and I was at peace with that, right? I do write in Battlegrounds about it being a toxic environment, about everybody really not taking the same approach to his or her job as maybe I did, having served by the time I joined the administration 33 years as an active duty officer. This was my fifth commander in chief since entering West Point at the age of 17, right? So, you know, I think there are some people who serve in Washington for purposes other than to serve the elected president and do their best under the Constitution. Some of them have other agendas.
Yes, I've noticed that phrase "used up" has come up a number of times in your interviews around this book. What do you mean by that? Is there a distinction between feeling used up versus feeling used? Do you have any regrets about your time there? Grudges, unfinished business, or things that you wish you'd done differently?
Well, I mean, the job's never done, right, with any of these challenges. So the two regrets leaving were, first of all, I was leaving my military career after 34 years. So I had been involved in missions, important missions abroad, you know, that were critical to our country's security. And I was leaving behind my fellow soldiers, you know, my brothers and sisters who I'd fought alongside for so long. And that's tough, right? Leaving them behind. And they're still in the fight, right? Because the wars, particularly in Afghanistan and across the Middle East and in Iraq and Syria in particular, were not finished. You know, they're not going to be finished, I don't think, for the foreseeable future. So that was tough, leaving behind teammates. But I decided when I took the job, Ben, that I was going to retire out of that job. Right, I wanted it to be clear that I wasn't taking the job to get a fourth star or something, you know, or to advance my career. But you know, I also regretted leaving behind the issues, right, and the work on policy. But as I mentioned, you know, I got to the point where I don't think I was, you know, I was able to do that as effectively as when I began the job, and a lot of that had to do with those who were in, you know, the White House, in the administration, and I think this is true of any administration, that are there not to serve the president and give the president options, but they're there instead to advance their own agenda, right? And so that I mentioned the second duty is to run that process. I think, Ben, we ran it extremely well, but some people didn't like that. Actually, they didn't want the president to have options, plural. And then there's a third group of people that I would say kind of cast themselves in the role of saving the country, maybe the world, from the president, right? This is the kind of the anonymous author and what's dangerous about that is those two groups of people, I mean, they're undermining the Constitution. Nobody elected them, right, to make policy.
True. Yeah, I want to talk about your previous book for just a moment here, because in Dereliction of Duty, another book of yours that I've read, you write at length about the failures of President Johnson's military advisors to push back against Johnson's assumptions about Vietnam and to give him unvarnished advice because, A, LBJ is a tough person to challenge, let's be honest, and also because they didn't want to get shut out of the loop. Having now been in that position as National Security Advisor, did you feel yourself up against some of those same pressures to maybe be careful with your advice or avoid anything that might contradict the president's preferences on a given issue?
Well, Ben, I mean, I didn't deliberately antagonize the president for sure, but I never held back, right? And I think that was due in part to my research on Vietnam. I was given this great gift, right? I mean, the Army And service in our military is super rewarding, right, for a number of reasons. But service as an officer affords you an opportunity to really grow as a person consistent with the adult education model, right? You're given challenging jobs, right, that allow you to grow as a person and grow as a leader. And then you typically take kind of a break to read, think, write, and study your profession to really understand better what you just learned and prepare for the next level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I had the opportunity to go to graduate school full time at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and study history, and then write a dissertation, which became Dereliction of Duty. And that, I'll tell you, that paid off. I mean, it was probably the best preparation I had for National Security Advisor, because what I had identified through the research and interviews, listening to tapes of phone conversations and meetings, is that many of the president's advisors decided, hey, I'm going to tell Lyndon Johnson what he wants to hear, right? Because if I don't, I'll lose my influence with him. Well, of course, that begs the question, what good is your influence anyway, right? If you're not going to tell him what you really think, what good are you doing the president and what good are you doing the country? So yeah, I knew that I had a shelf life, in that environment, and I was at peace with that. I was fine with that.
Speaking more generally, you've been called independent, a rebel, an iconoclast for some time now. How do you advance in the military and earn 3 stars and still speak your mind when you need to? How do you do that without committing career suicide in that business?
Well, you know, I mean, there's this conventional wisdom, right, that the military is very much, you know, conformist, right? Like, right. The expectation is, you know, don't challenge authority. You know, the only proper response when your boss has a good idea is, you know, I wish I had thought of that, sir. You know, and that's really, but that's not the case. I mean, the military wants candid feedback because, you know, the stakes are high, especially in war when the stakes are life and death, right? So in the U.S. military, which is not the same with all militaries, you know, we encourage candid feedback, respectful feedback, but candid feedback. And I think in any walk of life, you can't go wrong if you're humble about it, right? And if you always bring it back to the objective, and you can just say, hey, whatever commander is, or hey, Mr. President, right? is this what you're trying to achieve? And then once you confirm that, say, well, let me bring you a couple other options that I think might be more effective in accomplishing your objective or your goal. And I'm sure it's like this in the corporate world as well. Well, sometimes you bump up against somebody that's just, you know, incorrigible, right? Somebody that's just difficult to work for, you know, and that happens in all walks of life. It happens in the military too. But in my experience, that was very rarely that happened.
Well, the full title of your 1997 book was Dereliction of Duty, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Lies That Led to Vietnam. And now you've written a book that in large part is about the lies and misguided assumptions that the U.S. has been telling itself ever since the fall of the Soviet Union. I wonder, can these two books be viewed as a piece? And are there some themes and problems that remain consistent across those 55 years?
Well, Ben, thanks. I mean, I think one of the themes that cuts across both of them is this idea of strategic competence. What does it mean to be able to develop sound strategies to overcome complex problems and challenges? And I think many times as Americans, you know, we just rush into action, you know, and with an incomplete understanding of the problem. And so I outline in Battlegrounds at the end, really what I think is the process that you have to undertake to develop a sound, competent, sustainable foreign policy and national security strategy. And first, it is to really understand these challenges on their own terms, to view them through the lens of vital interest, to craft those objectives, but then to importantly to pay attention to the competitive environment that you're in, and to recognize that the future course of events depends not only on what you might like to do, but on the adversary's aspirations, you know, their strategy, and their actions, which are also oftentimes difficult to predict from the outset. And so I use this term in the book, strategic narcissism, to describe how we tend to define these challenges only in relation to us. And then to consider that what we're going to do is decisive to the outcome. We oftentimes then engage in wishful thinking, mirror imaging, and ultimately self-delusion. I mean, I tell a story of Battlegrounds about my trusty sidekick on many missions in the Middle East, a guy named Colonel retired now, Joel Rayburn, who's now working in the State Department, just a wonderful servant of the nation. And we were discussing the complete disconnect at the time between our strategy and policy that was developed in Washington and the situation on the ground in Iraq that had really led to the situation in which we were in a rush to failure there. And he said, hey, sir, you know, what's the problem is we are in Iraq, we're in Iraq, and in Washington, they're basing the strategy on Iraq, and Iraq is anything you want it to be. And so I think the main theme that connects the two books is strategic competence and how to think about these complex problems and how to develop sound policies and strategies.
Yeah, readers might be surprised at how many times the word empathy comes up in this book and in other conversations that I've heard you have, even talking about the George Floyd murder or empathy in foreign policy. What's the role of empathy in national security?
Right. I think it's immensely important. I borrowed this term from my friend Zachary Short, who's a brilliant historian. He's written some great books. One of them is called Blunder: Why Smart People Make Dumb Decisions. And then there's another one called A Sense of the Enemy, in which he introduces this term strategic empathy. And he means that it's very important to view these competitions from the perspective of the other, adversaries, rivals, enemies, and in particular, to pay attention to the emotions, the aspirations, the ideology, the historical memory and culture that drives and constrains the other. Oftentimes we do engage in mirror imaging and we think, well, it would be in our interest to do, you know, fill in the blank. Therefore, it must be in our adversary's interest to do the same. So in each of the parts of the book, I try to view these challenges from the perspective of the other with particular attention to how really the past produced the present and how others' historical memory color really their actions today and how they see the future.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. You talk about this rosy assumption that the era of big competition ended with the Cold War. That obviously hasn't been the case. Who do you see as the greater or more menacing competitor to the United States right now, China or Russia?
It's the Chinese Communist Party because of the resources that they have available and how ambitious they are. And of course, again, considering the ideology and the emotions that are driving them. And as I write in this part of the book, which I really enjoyed researching and reading and writing about, you know, I was relatively new to China when I took the job of National Security Advisor. And I, as a historian, I really enjoyed learning more about Chinese history and then using the history that Chairman Xi Jinping draws on, as well as the history that he avoids talking about, you know, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, to how that provides a window into what's driving him. And I argue that it's a combination of fear and ambition, the party's fear of losing control. And that's why you see them extending and tightening their exclusive grip on power with this technologically enabled Orwellian surveillance police state. Sorry for all the adjectives, but that's kind of what it is, you know. And they're stifling human freedom inside of China in the most draconian ways. You know, weaponizing people's social networks against them, and then engaging in a campaign of cultural genocide in Xinjiang, which just in recent days we received more news, right, of the expansion of these camps and even more draconian measures. You know, birth rates are down something like 60%. I mean, it's egregious what's occurring. The repression of freedom in Hong Kong, and now the jingoistic and threatening language oriented on Taiwan, bludgeoning Indian soldiers to death on the Himalayan frontier. Yeah. I mean, they are determined to ensure that there are no threats on their borders within their country. But then it's a grand ambition as well to take center stage in the world, to create exclusionary areas of primacy across the Indo-Pacific region, and then to challenge the United States globally and really the free world globally.
Do you think that this global pandemic that began in China may actually turn out to be a net positive for China in the sense that it's provided sufficient distraction for China to do things like crack down on the protests in Hong Kong, cement its claims in the South China Sea, ramp up its threat against Taiwan?
Right. And this wolf-weir diplomacy, they've been super aggressive with that, you know,
yes.
As well as, I mean, massive cyber attacks on Australia across every sector. And then having the gall, right, to attack our biomedical research facilities and pharmaceutical companies and labs in the midst of a pandemic, you know. So I think it has emboldened them. I think it's a combination, right, I think COVID has catalyzed a lot of the challenges in battlegrounds, but it's also, I think, created an impression for them that this fleeting window of opportunity that they have, you know, to take what they view as their rightful place in the world might be closing even more rapidly based on the recession in China associated with COVID, even though they are the first to emerge and to begin their growing their economy again. So I think there's also a sense of desperation here. There's the other factor that Xi Jinping is coming up on the Communist Party plenum here in Congress in 2022. And this is when he wants to make good on everything. I think this is when he clearly wants to be then the ruler for life at that stage and be the next Mao Zedong. So he feels a sense of personal pressure. And, you know, hey, if you're a dictator, you do surround yourself with yes men. And I bet he's hearing a lot of, hey, you're the greatest. We're on top. We're winning. Look at the United States. The United States is struggling with COVID and the recession. And now look at the social divisions laid bare by George Floyd's murder, anger, you know, over unequal treatment and inequality of opportunity and the racial divide and so forth. And I think, you know, he's probably believing the people around him and maybe even believing their own propaganda. You know, I tell the story of battlegrounds where I just tell, you know, really how the party does it with their own population. But you know, every newscast in China is, you know, the first 15 minutes is you know, how great Xi Jinping is and the senior Chinese Communist Party's leader. The next 15 minutes is how they're winning, right? How their system is great, and how their economic growth is proceeding at pace and infrastructure projects and just, you know, just tremendous achievements across the board. And then the next 15 minutes is how screwed up the West is, how screwed up, you know, all those democracies are with these crazy ideas of rule of law and that the people should actually have a say in how they're governed, you know? So I think that it is a very dangerous time as a result of that. I think COVID-19, for a variety of reasons, has catalyzed these challenges and in particular, the aggression of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, and I actually enjoyed your section describing the president's visit to China and sort of the tourist stops that you guys made and the photo ops that were very deliberately crafted, some would say manipulated, to present a very specific message to the Chinese people. Talk a little about that.
Well, to the Chinese people, the message is, look, the leader of what used to be the greatest power on earth has come to the Middle Kingdom to pay homage to Chairman Xi, but then also the message was to countries in the region too, with which the Chinese Communist Party is trying to develop servile relationships in a number of ways, just straight up intimidation, right? At an APEC conference in 2015, this is Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Organization that brings together countries across South Asia, Southeast Asia. And my old interlocutor, Yang Jinshur, you know, who's now a Politburo member and has the foreign portfolio, you know, he just said to all the countries gathered, hey, you know, we're a big country, you're little countries, get used to it. So the Chinese Communist Party is not very subtle about any of this, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that they're becoming more and more aggressive in the region. And so Trump's visit was meant to show them, hey, look who's in charge here, right? And this is the language they try to use, right? When they say a new kind of great power relationship, you know, some of the phrases they use, they sound kind of innocuous, but as soon as you use them, if you use them as a U.S. leader, they just bludgeon mm-hmm. their neighbors with it. Hey,
doesn't cut
you know what this means? This is a G2. This is G2. Mm-hmm. That means the world's divided between the U.S. and China. And guess what side of the world you're on? So you better get with the program. I mean, that's their message.
Yeah, and China is a little bit different of a problem from Russia or North Korea or Iran in the sense that our two economies are so entangled that I don't really know where the U.S. can find leverage over China. What do you see as the levers that can be pulled to pressure China?
Well, this is really important question. You're right. A lot of people say it's Cold War. I think it is a competition that we want to stay cold, right? When it would be disastrous to go to war with China, but China has to be deterred, and it's important for us to work with like-minded partners, which we are. But I think we need to really ramp up at this stage international cooperation, because on, for example, Chinese economic aggression, the non-tariff barriers to entry to their market, the wide range of unfair trade and economic practices, subsidization of these national champion industries, which then produce goods at artificially low prices and dump them on the global market, and then corner the market in a way that's unfair to U.S. and other businesses and workers. And look what they've done with renewable energy, solar panels, and high storage, high density batteries. I mean, you could just go on, right? It's a combination of forced transfer of intellectual property and sensitive technology, plus an economic model that is inherently statist and mercantilist. And what I describe as their strategy is one of co-option, coercion, and concealment, right? Mm-hmm. So they co-opt you in with the lure of the market, which you're really not going to get anyway if it's a market they really care about. And then once they co-opt you, they coerce you to adhere to their worldview, to support their foreign policy, and then they treat that coercion like it's just normal business practices. Look at the NBA, look at Marriott. I mean, you can fill in the blank for companies that have been coerced by the party.
Well, I want to move on to Russia next. You address the great mystery of the Trump-Putin relationship and why Donald Trump seems to have a particular affinity, some would say deference, to Vladimir Putin. You say in here, quote, "While some speculated that President Trump sometimes appeared to be an apologist for Russia and Mr. Putin because the Kremlin was extorting him with damaging evidence of business improprieties or embarrassing personal conduct, Trump's over-optimism about improving Russian relations fit a pattern of optimism bias and wishful thinking across two previous administrations." Now, of course, we all remember Bush's comment about seeing into Vladimir Putin's soul and Hillary Clinton standing with Lavrov with that infamous reset button. But for Trump, a president who seemingly makes decisions based on doing the mirror opposite of Bush and especially Obama, how did he fall into that same Putin trap, so to speak?
Right. Well, actually, both by the end of the George W. Bush and the end of the Obama administration, there were no longer any illusions about Vladimir Putin, right? Both administrations learned the hard way. So if you recall, it was just right on the end of the Russian attack on the election, an attack that really they meant to polarize us, to reduce our confidence in our democratic principles and institutions and processes. The Obama administration imposed some significant sanctions on the Russians, kicking out some of their undeclared intelligence officers, closing, a DACA, that they had kind of an intelligence facility, I think, in Maryland, and place sanctions on them. And so this was the agenda for Putin coming in, is to try to get those sanctions lifted. When President Trump came in, he is, I think, a bit reflexively contrarian. And you hear him say all the time, right? Wouldn't it be great if we had a really good relationship with Russia? But I try to point out in battlegrounds, other administrations said the same thing. And I wish we would just stop. We would just stop, harboring this illusion, that Putin's going to be like the Grinch at Christmas, right? His heart's going to grow two sizes bigger. He's going to give the toys back to Whoville, and is going to integrate back into the community of responsible nations. It's just not going to happen. And what I try to cover in Battlegrounds is why that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. What's really motivating Putin?
And you say in Battlegrounds that the original intention early on was for there to be a direct line of communication between Trump and Putin, but that didn't work out. So it sort of fell to you to establish that line of communication with your Russian counterpart, Nikolai Patrushev. Tell us about your first meeting with him.
So, actually, there was a relationship with direct line of communication between President Trump and President Putin, but I wanted a second one, in the White House, just for routine coordination before phone calls and after phone calls to make sure that whatever they discussed, we could build momentum on and maybe actually find some areas of cooperation, or at least get the Russians to stop acting against American interests, even when it cut against their own interests. Right. So, mm-hmm. So I thought that after really giving a year for Secretary of State Tillerson to work on really his pre-existing relationship with Lavrov and with Putin, it just wasn't getting as far as we wanted it to get. And what we hope to do is to begin to cultivate more relationships with different agencies and departments other than the State Department to at least make some progress in some areas. You know, I mean, who knows, maybe arms control or nonproliferation. So in March, I think it was March of 2018, maybe March of 2018, I decided to meet with Patrushev, my counterpart, in Geneva, and to establish this communication. And you know, the object of the meeting was not that ambitious, right? It was just, hey, let's inventory our interests, right? Let's really have a better understanding, an explicit understanding of where those interests converge and where they diverge. That way we could, you know, maybe work on a couple things together that are in our mutual interest, but then manage those divergent interests and really avoid what would be a disastrous conflict for both countries. And as we were meeting, you know, the week before, just before the meeting, our forces in Syria, our partner forces and our special operations forces had clashed with Russian mercenaries, and really in a very significant engagement, killed about 200 Russians in this engagement, right? And so we didn't even talk about that, Patrushev and I. It was just understood, I think, that this provided, you know, a bit of an impetus for us to develop better communications. Now, of course, there are communications military to military over Syria and so forth, but this was, you know, at the White House Kremlin level to be able to pick up the phone and talk to somebody, clarify intentions, manage difficult circumstances. And of course, as I write in Battlegrounds, I mean, the reason to do this is pretty obvious, right? I mean, both the United States and Russia are nuclear powers, and the stakes would be high in connection with any kind of miscalculation. So we had that meeting. I described in the book, you know, how we came to an initial understanding, and then we were going to work together in a sustained manner. But I knew at the time, obviously, I didn't tell Patrushev that my days were numbered, you know. So, and I'd already had an initial conversation with the president about leaving sometime we had envisioned later on in that year. But what I hoped that meeting would do was lay the groundwork for whoever my successor was going to be, you know, to pick up that kind of dialogue, because national security advisor relationships are important because you're right there with the head of state, right? And it's not to supplant in any way, you know, the very important role, the dominant role in foreign policy that a Secretary of State has, for example, and his contacts with the foreign minister. But, you know, in many of these countries, even the foreign minister doesn't really speak. So a national security advisor's relationship with a counterpart can really augment, you know, the relationships between heads of state, right? Because you can get a lot done, you know, before phone calls, after phone calls, before meetings, after meetings. And then oftentimes it's a way just to deliver really candid, frank messages, you know, back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to open that up. And then obviously the idea would be, you know, since it was kind of late in my tenure there as national security advisor, to hand that off to my successor.
I know that you pushed back with Patrushev on Russian interference in the U.S. election and the hacking of the DNC and so forth. And apparently you also say that some of the same people who were behind that were behind the whole hashtag Fire McMaster campaign on social media. I'm curious, how do you know that? What do you base that on?
Well, there was a lot of open source research, right? So initially it was the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Lab who uncovered a lot of this, as well as investigative journalists. It was pretty well covered at the time. It was called at the time the largest coordinated, you know, Russian bot / alt-right campaign against anybody. So I guess it's a form of a compliment. But I think what this shows is how Russia's getting much more sophisticated, right? They're not only are they trying to polarize us, our society, and polarize us politically, and pit us against each other and diminish our confidence in one another. But they're also really determined, I think, to put sticks in the spokes of our government, right? To really kind of disrupt even the functioning, you know, of an administration by really feeding into the dissent, within administrations or with competitions within government. And they're getting more and more adept at cultivating, you know, witting and especially unwitting agents, you know, in the United States who helped them do their damage, right? They typically the Russians, they can't create the issue, right? You know, but they can make it worse. You know, they can magnify it.
Aside from your general reputation as a Russia hawk, do you ever wonder what you did specifically to land yourself in the crosshairs of Putin's internet trolls?
I think maybe because I harbored no illusions about Vladimir Putin and what the direction, his government was headed, and so I think they saw maybe me as an impediment in a few areas. You know, one is certainly any alleviation of sanctions. I mean, you know, the president had put more sanctions on the Russians in this first year of his presidency than the Obama administration did in 8 years of his presidency. The decision the president made to provide defensive capabilities to the Ukrainians. And then also the Russian agenda was really to effect a complete pullout of U.S. forces in Syria and Iraq, as well as Afghanistan. And the president delivered a South Asia strategy in April of 2017 that was much different than what Russia would have seen. And that's not to say that they attributed all that to me, but I think they saw me as somebody who was actually advocating policies that they saw cut against their interests, the opposite of what they wanted to see, as well as somebody who was taking kind of a tough stance on Putin, really under the theory that he wouldn't stop his destructive and disruptive capabilities or efforts against us, what I describe in Battlegrounds as Russian new generation warfare, unless we impose costs on Putin that were far greater than what he factored in at the outset of his decision making.
You mentioned Afghanistan, and as we wind down here, I have to ask about that. That's somewhere where you've served. You say in the book that Afghanistan has been a one-year war fought over and over again for 20 years. What do you mean by that?
Well, exactly that, Ben. We have not had a sustained, sound strategy in Afghanistan from the beginning. At times we got it right, but then we would abandon that strategy prematurely. And so what happened paradoxically, right? In 2001, we had an extremely successful military campaign where we enabled Afghan militias with our courageous special forces soldiers and intelligence people, and our magnificent air power capabilities, right? And what that did is that affected the rapid collapse of the Taliban regime, but it was an insufficient strategy to consolidate gains and get to a sustainable political outcome on the ground. And you know, the consolidation of gains has never been like an optional phase of war, right? Unless it's a raid that you're doing. And so this short war mentality actually led to a longer and more costly war. We then turned our attention quite rapidly after that military success in Afghanistan toward Iraq. Afghanistan was neglected in terms of, you know, what comes next after the Taliban. How can the Afghan state be hardened and strengthened against the regenerative capacity of the Taliban, which lies, you know, across the border in Pakistan? We didn't endeavor to do that until really the very end of the Bush administration. And then as the Obama administration came in, he was quite eager to disengage from wars abroad, even what he had called the good war in Afghanistan. And this is why in 2009, he announces at the same time as a troop reinforcement, the timeline for their withdrawal. Now, I mean, in all the wars I'm familiar with in history, I don't think that's ever been done. And of course, it's never been done because it makes no sense to do that. Because you're telling your enemy your plans in advance. All they have to do is wait you out. And then there were a series of adaptations to strategy over time, none of which were particularly sound or long-term and were based on flawed assumptions about the enemy and the nature of the problem in Afghanistan and what was at stake. And I think it shouldn't come as any surprise that the American people lost faith in the effort. Their leaders didn't really do for them what they deserved, which is A, explain what is at stake, and B, explain what is the strategy that will deliver an outcome consistent with our vital security interests at a cost that's acceptable. And then I think the true test of strategy, having been on the receiving end of strategies that made no sense or little sense in both Iraq and Afghanistan, is can you explain to the soldiers who are about to go out on a dangerous mission how the risks that they're about to take and the sacrifices they may be called on to make are contributing to an outcome worthy of those risks and worthy of those sacrifices? And it was only rarely in the wars since 9/11 when commanders have been able to do that, because our strategies developed in Washington have been fundamentally flawed. And I describe more about why that's the case and then what is needed to restore our strategic competence in battlegrounds.
Well, I know that you have to go, and I appreciate your generosity with your time. Real quickly, I just want to ask, did the National Security Council in your time have a strategy for a global pandemic? And if so, where has it gone wrong now?
Right. Well, we did, right? And what this shows you is, hey, you can have the best plan. You know, the key is implementation. The plan, and really, I think this is still quite relevant today, it has three main components. The first is, hey, stop it before it's a pandemic, right? I mean, you know, identify a virus and then stop it locally before it becomes a huge global problem. Thanks to the policies of the Chinese Communist Party, we couldn't do that. The lies, the repression of human-to-human transmission, the punishment of the doctors who were trying to blow the whistle, the subversion of the World Health Organization. The second key is to be able to mobilize a biomedical response. And this is where we had problems, right? We couldn't react fast enough. And we couldn't react fast enough in large measure because our supply chains had become overly fragile. They were biased in favor of efficiency rather than effectiveness. They were over-reliant on China. And so it took time. It took time to catch up there, right? The laws of physics still apply in the 21st century. And we were behind on some pharmaceuticals, but you know, personal protective equipment and so forth. Related to mobilizing the biomedical response, that second key task is also just a fact, right? We're a federal system, and we have a combination of public and private healthcare. Coordination among the public and private sector, sharing of information, and the levels of government was not as good as it needed to be. And so those, I think, are the two big takeaways in terms of disappointments, failures, areas of improvement for this pandemic or a future biomedical crisis. And then the third is innovation. And Ben, this is where I think we're going to get high marks, you know, because it's really the rapid development of therapies and the rapid development of vaccines. And because in the job I had before I went into the White House, my job was to help design the future army. And we put a lot of money and resources into rapid vaccine prototyping. And then importantly, being able to manufacture vaccines at scale, right? And we've done this across multiple administrations. It's going to pay off. It's going to pay off in ways that are going to save a lot of lives and help us get back to growing our economy and then really a period of introspection that I think is necessary after these triple crises we've been through in recent months.
Well, I certainly hope so. And I've enjoyed the conversation. Again, the book is called Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. H.R. McMaster, thanks so much for talking with me.
Hey, Ben, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks again to H.R. McMaster for coming on the show. Order his new book, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.